Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Hello everyone, welcome back. What's your week been like, Molly?
My week has been fine. I went to the theatre twice.
What did you see?
I went to see Present Laughter at the Old Vic with Andrew Scott, which was really interesting. Good, really nice production.
Mm.
They do a gender swap in it. You know, have you read
about it? Yes, I read about it. Yeah.
But I thought he was amazing. He's obviously great.
He's very good indeed.
And I also went to a musical which has taken the... I don't know about world. It is doing an international tour called Six, which is about the six wives of Henry VIII.
Crikey.
And it's like a pop concert. And each wife, they have a sort of sing-off to say who had a worse time as the wife of Henry. Oh. It's really, really good fun. I would really recommend it.
Where is it?
It's at the Arts Theatre. You know that funny, pokey little theatre just off Longacre? Well,
oh.
Not, you know, it used to be...
off Leicester Square?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, not the one where Spotlight is.
Oh, okay.
It's the other side, by that big Pret. You
know? Oh, yes, I know.
Yeah, oh, very odd.
Crikey.
I go to showcases there quite a lot.
I'm sure you do.
How's your week?
I did some more filming. In fact, interestingly, I filmed a case that was our second podcast.
Yeah, I know.
Arthur
you
Hutchinson.
Did Arthur Hutchinson, the Wedding Massacre.
Wedding
Massacre at Door.
And this was another of World's Most Evil Killers. But yes, it brought back, I even went back and listened to the podcast.
Oh yeah, you can use your own work as research.
Yes, so I did. I went back to that, which I found hugely amusing. And actually, it's a fascinating and very interesting case. And I can quite see why we did it as the second one we ever did. The only other thing I was going to mention is I found a book which I think is very interesting. It's called This Mortal Boy. It's by Fiona Kidman, and it's a novel published by Gallic, who aren't a very big publisher, but certainly available in most good bookshops. And it's based broadly on a true story, but it's fiction. But it's about something which is very close to the heart of this podcast, which is an Irishman crosses the world to go live in New Zealand. It's Auckland in New Zealand in October 1955. And a young man stands accused of murder. He pulled a knife. And asks a question. Should his actions, lead him to the gallows? It is a never-ending question. Does
capital punishment?
Yes. Does the death penalty, can it ever be justified? My views are known, and I haven't changed them. I've never been in favour of the death penalty because of the one innocent man argument. But I have said on a number of occasions that were someone to plead guilty to a heinous crime and to do so before a judge, is there any circumstance in which they should deserve the death penalty? Yes, because there's no question of an innocent man argument.
Oh, if they've confessed to it.
They've confessed. They pleaded guilty. Most people plead guilty because they will think they're going to get a softer sentence. Even though the crime is heinous. It's a very, very interesting question. And this book does raise it and deals with it very, very well. It's very moving and complicated question. It asks you to examine your view.
What's the thing Gandhi said? Like, if you take an eye for an eye, then everyone will end up blind, don't they?
Well, yeah, there is that. I mean,
it's like, I don't think I believe in you killed someone, so we kill you. I don't know. I don't think I believe in that.
Okay. But you know, you'll notice that the Americans are increasingly going back to the death penalty. Trump has already said this week that he wants more states to consider returning to the death penalty. I don't see that happening in this country, but I can see a power in the argument. And I think it's interesting, for example, that we've just appointed a new Home Secretary in this country, who earlier, not now, she's renounced the view, who earlier campaigned, or at least suggested, that there was a case for bringing back the death penalty for the worst cases of murder. It's an issue that is never going to go away.
Yeah, no, that's a big question.
Well, let me. The reason I raise it is the podcast we're going to do today is a very, very emotional, powerful one.
Which raises the question.
Yes.
Great, so we'll get going. We are doing Beverly Allett today, who we will call the Angel of Death.
We are indeed. Beverly Allett, or to give her her full name, Beverly Gail Allett, was born on the 4th of October, 1968. She'll be 51 this October. She was born near Grantham in Lincolnshire. Birthplace, of course, of Margaret Thatcher, the late Margaret Thatcher. She had two sisters and one brother. Her father, Richard, worked in an off-licence, and her mum was a school cleaner. It was a poor family. Beverly wasn't a very clever girl, but what she was an attention seeker. She didn't get into the local grammar school and went instead to the local secondary modern and left at 16 to study nursing at Grantham College. It took her a very long time to qualify. She couldn't pass the... struggled to pass the exam. She did eventually. But she'd also had a sort of sideline when she was growing up as a teenager of babysitting local families in the area of Corby Glen near Grantham. One of the things that she did as an adolescent was she would wear bandages or a cast on her arm.
Well, even though that she wasn't hurt.
She wasn't hurt. Because she wanted to draw attention to herself. She thought she was special. She was also often very aggressive as a teenager, as an adolescent. And indeed, she started going to hospital and complaining of all sorts of illnesses to such an extent that at one point they extracted a perfectly healthy appendix because she insisted she had appendicitis.
That's so weird.
It's real attention-seeking. Is there
like a name for attention-seeking, yes. Like Munchausen syndrome?
Bang on, Molly. Well done. Munchausen syndrome. That's harming yourself.
Okay.
Okay? We'll come to the other one a little later. Okay. Well done, though. She took to self-harm, the Munchausen syndrome point, and she also took to that well-known attention-seeking device of doctor hopping. If a doctor said to her, "You've got nothing wrong with you," she would go to another doctor in another place. I mean, this is the desire for attention was absolutely astounding. And one early boyfriend called her aggressive, manipulative, and deceptive, and claimed false pregnancy as well as rape.
Now, that's against him.
That's
awful.
Yes, but it's further evidence of this extraordinary mindset of Beverly Allett. She finally passes her nursing exams as a state-enrolled nurse, not a state-registered nurse. It's a slightly lower category, and gets a job in the Children's Ward 4. At the very understaffed Grantham and Kesteven Hospital. There are only two trained nurses on this children's ward during the day and one at night. The other half of Munchausen syndrome is called Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where instead of harming yourself, you harm others. And so,
Sorry, I was just thinking, when you were talking about her personality before, do you think it's also a bit like a God complex?
Oh, yes, certainly. But it's not a God complex in the sense that you believe you're above everyone.
Yeah.
There are certain different... There are all sorts of...
Not like Brady.
No, not like Brady. But this is a proper... a kind of self-abuse, a distorted view of reality, of civilization, an extraordinary self-importance. And so Alet displayed what can only be called severe personality disorders. But the tragedy of the case, and it is, I think, one of the most tragic we've dealt with in this podcast, is in a period of just 59 days, between February and April 1991, Alet killed 4 children, attempted to kill 3 others, and caused grievous bodily harm to a further 6. In 59 days.
It's a high hit rate.
It's terrifying.
How old was she then?
She was born in 1968, so she'd be 23.
23?
Yes.
She killed those children when she was 23?
Yes.
That's terrifying.
Yes. It is terrifying. And there's no way I can conceal how horrible it is. But it's worth just gently going through the timetable and the people. The first child to die at Alet's hands was very shortly after she got there.
So once she'd started working on this understaffed...
Children's Ward 4. The first little boy was only a matter of weeks old. It was called Liam Taylor. Liam was admitted to the ward for a chest infection and was killed on the 22nd of February 1991.
And is this the first nursing job she had?
I'm so sorry?
Is that the first nursing job that she had?
Yes.
Right.
The only nursing
do
job.
Do you think she got into nursing to do this?
I think it's highly likely. Interesting. I think by this point, Alet has so distorted her vision of reality that she sees this as yet a further way of drawing attention to herself, which is why it's Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
So Liam?
Liam was the first to die. The second was a boy called Timothy Hardwick, who was 11, in fact, the oldest of her victims. Timothy had cerebral palsy and was admitted to the ward after having an epileptic seizure. He was killed on the 5th of March, 1991. The next victim survived. She was called Kaylee Desmond. She was a year old. She also had a chest infection. Alet attempted to murder her on the 8th of March, but the child was resuscitated and transferred to another hospital where she recovered. A little time passes until another boy, Paul Crampton, then 5 months old, survives. He's admitted again with a chest infection on the 20th of March. Alet tried to kill him with an insulin overdose on 3 occasions. The day before, he was transferred to another hospital where he recovered. On the following day, Bradley Gibson, then 5, was admitted with pneumonia. He suffered 2 cardiac arrests on the 21st of March due to insulin injections, overdoses administered by Alet, before he was transferred to another hospital where he recovered. The following day, Michael Davidson, then 6, is admitted to the Children's Ward for post-operative care following operation to remove an air rifle pellet that he'd been injured with in an accident. After being injected with insulin a number of times through a cannula in his hand, he suffered from cyanosis and fell unconscious before being stabilised by other doctors on the ward. he later made a full recovery. The same day, Yik Hung Chan, also known as Henry, who was two, was admitted to the ward following a fall. He suffered an oxygen desaturation attack before he was transferred to another hospital where he recovered. I find this really difficult. Becky Phillips, who was 2 months old, was admitted to the ward with gastroenteritis on the 1st of April 1991. She too was administered an insulin overdose by Alit and died at home 2 days later. Her death was originally thought to have been a cot death. Becky's twin sister, Katie, then two, was admitted to hospital in the wake of Becky's death because they...
2 months or two?
2 months.
Okay.
Becky and Katie were twins.
Okay.
And their parents were very concerned in case...
Another cot death.
Another cot death.
Yeah.
Katie had to be resuscitated twice after unexplained episodes, later found to be caused by insulin and potassium overdoses. Following the second time, she stopped breathing. She was transferred to another hospital, but by this time had suffered permanent brain damage, partial paralysis, and partial blindness due to the lack of oxygen. Her parents had been so grateful for Alit's care of Becky, the one that died, that her mother asked, they'd asked her to, Alit, to be Katie's godmother.
That is tragic.
It's an absolutely tragic case. But Katie did survive, although eventually she was awarded £2.125 million by Lincolnshire Health Authority.
You'd need so much palliative care, like
to pay for treatment
care.
And equipment for the rest of her life. The Health Authority did not accept liability, but did acknowledge that Katie was entitled to compensation. And the final attack and death was a girl called Claire Peck, who was 15 months old. Remember, many of these are babies.
Tiny babies.
Little. Was admitted to the ward following an asthma attack on the 22nd of April 1991. After being put on a ventilator, she was left alone in Alit's care for a short interval, during which time she went into cardiac arrest. She was resuscitated but died after a second episode of cardiac arrest, again following a time when she was left alone with Beverly Alit.
So by this point, is that the end of the timeline? I want to know how they worked out it was her.
Yeah, well, it's Alit had attacked 13 children, four fatally, over a 59-day period. It was only following the death of Peck that the staff became suspicious of the number of cardiac arrests on the children's ward, and police were called in. It was discovered quickly that Alit was the only nurse on duty for all the attacks on the children, and also that she had access to drugs. But it took a very, very long time for them to track down exactly what had happened to the four dead children and also piece together the stories of what happened to the others. She was immediately, obviously, put on, suspension. But that does nothing to... It is not, in fact, until November she was finally charged with the murders. And she did not, in fact, appear for trial until, believe it or not, May 1993. 93? And the reason was, of course, Alit is by this time on remand. She has become anorexic. She's constantly going into hospital, coming out of hospital, going back to hospital, coming out of hospital, back on remand. It's the first time that they manage to get her actually in the dock to be, you know, she enters a plea of not guilty to everything. 4 counts of murder, 11 counts of attempted murder, and 11 counts of causing grievous bodily harm. She pleaded not guilty to them all.
What did she say?
Well, she said, nothing to do with me. was the gist of it.
I'm looking at pictures of Beverly Allitt.
Yes, well, the most famous one is the chubby one, but if you later pictures of where she goes all thin.
God, it's absolutely terrifying.
Yes. What is so terrifying about the case is that is the wickedness of it. The sheer wickedness of attacking entirely defenseless, utterly innocent, mainly babies and children, in an entirely premeditated way. This must be one of the most devious, heartless, wicked killers it's possible to imagine. It's very hard not to be. I mean, we're not talking about Harold Shipman here. We're not talking about elderly ladies.
No, that's babies is. I mean, nothing's okay, but babies is.
It's tiny babies. Yes, it's depraved. That's the only word.
And causing that kind of pain to parents is just unbearable.
Yes. These are utterly defenseless children. And what warped imagination must have thought it was all right to effectively execute children she'd never met before while pretending to be caring for them. It is the worst of all devious crimes.
And also, like, making everybody continue to think that. You've got to almost have a kind of split personality or something to go to work every day and for parents and your colleagues to think you're doing your job, but actually you're doing the total opposite.
Yes. I'm always a bit worried about split personalities, because remember that we've done a case in which one man said, oh, it wasn't me, it was my alter ego.
Yeah, no, I don't mean that, though, but I mean, what kind of, you know, how do you function when, you know, how do you pretend everything is fine when in the background that's what you're doing? I mean, what kind of person can do that? Sociopath, I suppose.
Sociopathic, certainly. Yeah. I mean, at one point, Alec was interviewed by a man who, of whom I have some suspicions, Professor Roy Meadow, because I campaigned long and hard for the release of Sally Clark, who was convicted pretty much on Meadow's evidence, medical evidence, of killing her two little boys. But Alec did tell Meadow, I hate myself. And Meadow did say something interesting. He said therapy might alter her condition, but he would not cure it. She'd told him that her mind was like a box. I can open it so far, but no more.
What does that mean? Mind is like a box. I can open it so far, but no more.
Perhaps she can't see into the dark corners. Perhaps that's what she has in mind.
I don't know. That's a very peculiar thing to say.
It is. That's why I raised it.
I can open it so far, but no more.
Yes. Well, the fascinating thing, too, is that Alec only managed to actually attend 4 days of her trial because of her arguments about illnesses all the time.
Mm. Is she like that in prison now?
We'll come to that.
Okay.
She pleaded not guilty. Nevertheless, on May the 28th, 1993, she was finally convicted of all the charges and given a sentence of life with a minimum of 30 years. Well, if you do your arithmetic, she was in prison first in 1991. 30 years takes her to 2021.
My word, she could get let out.
Originally, the parents of some of the victims thought that she'd be given a minimum sentence of 40 years. But in fact, it was later confirmed that she would actually only been given a minimum tariff of 30 years. Alec was as attention-seeking as anyone could be. But most important of all, rather than being sent to any of the women's prisons, she manoeuvred it so that she could go to Rampton Secure Hospital. She was not a prisoner, but a patient. This is one...
Em- based on illness or mental illness? Physical illness or?
Mental. In summing up, the judge said that she was a danger, a serious danger to others.
Do you think that would be a War Boys style protest?
I think that's highly likely. She boasted that she would never be sent to prison, and she pulled it off. She's been given various sort of strange little interviews to people, saying, "I like it here. I've got more freedom." It absolutely infuriates the parents of the victims.
Obviously.
As you can't imagine. Chris Taylor, who's the father of the first victim, Liam, said if she goes to hospital, she gets what she wants. She should be sent to prison and made to stay there. If she wants to kill herself, then let her get on with it. But in an interview with Alet from a hospital, in the hospital, in Rampton, "What's the good thing about it?" the interviewer says. "Well, there's more freedom in here. Do you like it better than where you were before?" "Yeah." "Why?" "Oh, I've got more freedom. I'm not locked up all the time." But when questioned about remorse and motive, there's no response. "I don't know. I don't want to talk about it." It's never been convincingly explained why Alet did it.
But while she's in a mental hospital, do they not like have to do therapy and things in there?
They do. They do. I don't think she takes it very seriously. There's some very interesting photographs, if you search the web, of her with close-cropped hair, much thinner, reading a book. She could be, you know, could be anywhere, really. Another of the victims, she had, naturally, being Alet, she goes out for treatment at a hospital, an ordinary hospital. You know, they've got... And... One local said she should receive medical treatment where she is, not be brought out into the community with innocent people. It's disgusting. It sickens me that a killer like this can be brought into our community while children are around to receive treatment at the town's hospital. Anyway, I thought Rampton was a hospital. Why can't she be treated there? She should never be let out for any reason, guarded or not. People like
then?
Her should be made to wait. There's no need for her to be brought to an outside hospital.
What will happen to her?
Well, let's just finish up where she is. In July last year, 2018, she contracted sepsis.
Well, she actually was ill.
She actually was ill, but of course recovered. She has... Well, the only way you can explain it, and I'm not entirely convinced it's the accurate explanation, is that killing gave her power. It was about control. She controlled her own body first, self-harming the rest, and then she controlled others. The vulnerable children were, I think, and I'm not letting her off the hook, not for one second, a means to her own satisfaction, a means to her end. And... given the trauma that she did cause to so many parents, it guaranteed Alet an audience. It guaranteed her attention. Her father has always maintained her innocence.
Are you joking?
No, Richard Alet or has always maintained that Beverly is innocent. We do not think she had it in her to do the things they said she did. She's always looked after babies in the village, and lots of parents have trusted her with their children. They thought she was marvellous. And he ended by saying there are two sides to every story. Well, it's very loyal of her father, but I find it really quite difficult to believe. Health-wise, he went on to say, she's not brilliant, but mentally she's all right. Obviously she's upset, but she's pretty calm, and there's good people looking after her. The argument will come when the minimum period of 30 years is reached. She will only be in her 50s. Given the fact that she was regarded as a serious danger to life. It's difficult to see entirely what judicial system will do, what the parole board will do. In the High Court in 2007, Mr. Justice Stanley Burnton confirmed that she must serve the original minimum sentence of 30 years. But that 30 years is rapidly approaching. And we are, I think, for me, in the presence of a truly wicked woman.
She can't be released.
Well, she will no doubt mount a very considerable campaign. She's nothing if not deliberate and deceptive. I fear about Beverly Allitt. I do think on reflection that a secure mental hospital is the right place for her.
Maybe she'll just get loads of attention coming if she comes out, won't she? She'll like that.
Well, they'd have to give her another identity, wouldn't they? It's such a famous case.
Yeah.
They'd have to give her another identity.
And they'd have to move her somewhere.
Then we're into Venables and Thompson, aren't we?
Yeah.
The Bulger killers.
I know, yeah.
It's a very complex question. But all I would say is that Beverly Allitt is living what some of the parents call a life of Riley in Rampton at the state's expense, which is why I began this podcast asking the old question.
Capital punishment?
Yeah.
Do you think she should be put to death?
I'm not in favour of capital punishment, but I do think it's a very open argument. I'm particularly moved by this case because these were innocent, defenceless children.
Tiny children.
Who were completely in the charge.
Those twins, that's so horrible. I can't bear it.
How do you handle that?
And then to think that you were so grateful to her and...
You invited her to become a godmother.
Made her part of your lives and then you found out that it was her that did it. It's too grim. I can't bear it.
Yes, it is a very grim case. I mean, a lot of the cases we do are grim, but it's one that raises so many questions. Why? I don't think we've got a convincing argument. We can talk about Munchausen syndrome by proxy, and we can talk about attention seeking, and we talk about the need for control and all of that and power.
Hmm.
But is it really a sufficient explanation? Two, what should the state's reaction to that kind of crime be? We talked
life
about
term.
That.
Life term, whole, no minimum.
Whole life term. Well, funnily enough, at that point, whole life terms weren't nearly as popular as they have become.
Whole life term after, what did the psychoanalyst report say? Oh, yeah, you said that man said she'll never recover.
Yes.
So, yeah, whole life term.
Mm. Well, this wasn't
100%. Imagine being the judge that put that through, and then now you'll be like, not a good spot.
Time passes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't think she should be allowed out.
Well, that's why I think Beverly Allitt is a particularly wicked woman. And I also think it's a particularly interesting case because it asks us to ask ourselves these kind of complicated questions. It's not...
Nothing bad happened to her. She didn't have any reason for behaving like that.
Nope. There was no suggestion of any kind of abuse. She didn't hurt animals as a child. She didn't commit arson. All those classic serial killer symptoms.
Yeah.
She didn't... It was just this extraordinary ego. This overinflated ego. And it's still inflated, in my opinion, in Rampton.
Gosh.
So that is the case of Beverly Gale Allitt.
Thanks, Dad.
Let's talk about something cheerful.
Jeez.
After that, you need it.
That wasn't very jolly, was it?
No, it certainly wasn't. I'm sorry.
Don't apologise. That's absolutely fine.
But
thank you very much.
I think it's, you know, I've dealt now really with such a lot of death and destruction. I'm in danger of becoming almost inured to it. But something about Alet really does touch me deeply. It just seems so depraved.
I don't think you're inured to it. I think you're very sensitive.
But anyway, I'm going to try and think of more cheerful things.
Like more
filming next week. Oh. About another man.
I'm mainly excited about getting to have lunch. That's what I'm looking forward to. That's my cheerful thing.
Yeah, well, we always have lunch together after the podcast.
Yeah, I don't know. We never talk about that, listeners. But, you know, this we have lunch every Saturday together, Jeffrey and I.
For a lot of years.
Like 16, 17 years, I think. Yeah. I always make out it's way more years. I'm like 20 years.
No, it's not
so
that.
So it was when I was at university it started.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think it was the second time I went to university, so I would have been 23.
Yeah.
Maybe before. No, we did do it when I did classics.
Yes, you did.
So I was 21.
You were.
So 14 years.
Yes. Well, that's still a lot of years.
Anyway, we shall have lunch today, and I'm looking forward to it.
16 or 17 years, I think.
It's a lot of years.
It's a lot of years.
That's where the idea for this podcast was generated.
Exactly. And in fact, I think this was very much Molly's idea. I don't think I even knew what a podcast was. But it's been amazing.
And I did it for you, Dad.
And we've done it for 2 years.
2 years in October.
2 years in October, which is not far away. And it's been an enormous pleasure, if you can call talking about this sort of thing a pleasure. Okay. It's been fascinating. And even this week, I got a note in from somebody saying how much he liked it.
Well, our podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. You can contact us. We should just do the
contact. Oh, yeah. We'll have an email, bloodties.podcast@gmail.com or bloodties_pod on Instagram and on Twitter.
And is it bloodties_pod? Instagram?
No, that's it. Jeffrey doesn't understand Instagram.
I don't.
Yeah, so that's it. That's mystery. All you need.
What about Twitter?
Yeah, same. bloodties_pod, I think.
At Twitter?
It's not at Twitter. It's just, you just search that in Twitter.
Oh, crikey. It's all a mystery to me.
Anyway, thank you for listening and thank you to all the people that help us. And
yes,
thank
indeed.
You, Dad.
It's a pleasure, Molly. Thank you. But I always end by saying, please don't let this give you nightmares and do be careful out there.